To those with little dust, editorial. This is the first article of the Mountain Pass from 1964, in the first edition.
64.
Arthur Osborne. He used to, have whole editions on certain subjects, and if he couldn't get the material he wanted, he would write it as under a pseudonym himself. Islam or this or that, he would write.
He would quote himself?
No, but he would write it himself, but give himself a pseudo name.
Oh!
Under another name.
Pseudonym.
So, why would he do that?
Because he thought that everything not being covered, that should have been covered on that subject, so.
But why not just use his name?
What?
Why not just use his name?
Maybe. Humility or something.
Okay.
They want to be all knowing. It is related, and the story is no less significant, whether historically true or not, that after attaining enlightenment, the Buddha's first impulse was to abide in the effulgence of bliss without turning back to convey the incommunicable to mankind. Then he reflected, some that are who are clear-sighted and do not need my teaching, and some whose eyes are clouded with dust who will not heed it though given. But between these two there are also some with but little dust in their eyes who can be helped to see. And for the sake of these, I will go back among mankind and teach. It is for those with little dust in their eyes that this journal is intended. Its purpose is to show that there is a more satisfactory state than that of ignorant, confused, unguided, frustrated modern man. I hope so. And a higher, more satisfying, and more durable alternative for him than any provided by wealth or luxury, art or music, or the love between man and woman. That such a state can be attained in his lifetime, and that the purpose of all religions has been to lead men towards it, although in many different ways. I say towards, rather than to, because even though the supreme state may not be attained in this lifetime, the mere approach to it can bring a peace of mind and sense of well-being not otherwise attainable. Mystics have often had unsought glimpses of a higher or the highest state. Those who are psychic have out of the body and other experiences closed to the ordinary man. But all this is of little importance in the quest for realization. Such powers or experiences may be a help at certain stages of certain types of paths, but they may also be a hindrance and distraction, like the sirens whom Odysseus heard, but against whom he made his crew plug their ears. If the pleasures of the physical world are seductive, those of the subtle world are certainly no less so. Christ said that if a man attains the kingdom of heaven, all else shall be added to him, but that is after attaining. If seeks all else beforehand, is not likely to attain. It is safer to have one's ears plugged. The quest is no shorter and no less arduous, for those who have such powers and experiences than for those who have not. Realization is not something like music, for which some are by nature more gifted than others. It is fundamentally different. Since music requires the development of a faculty which is stronger in some and weaker in others, whereas realization is the discovery of an identification with the self that has the faculty. It is very hard, perhaps impossible, to say we can and will understand. It has certainly nothing in common with intellectual ability as commonly understood. Indeed, the scriptures of the various religions agree in warning that neither intellect nor learning is any qualification. They also can be a hindrance. Quote, it is rather the learned who are unlearned who are saved than those whose ego has not yet subsided in spite of their learning. Unquote. That's from the 40 verses supplement. And the humble knowledge of oneself is a surer way to God than deep researches after science. A scientist can fail to understand spiritual science. A philosopher be unreceptive to the perennial philosophy. A psychologist remains ignorant of what underlies the mind. On the other hand, a spiritual master may or may not be an intellectual. Ramana Maharshi was, but Sri Ramakrishna was ecstatic with the mind rather of a peasant than a philosopher. He didn't read any books. He couldn't read. But he knew the alphabet a little bit. I remember he tried teaching it to one of his disciples, I didn't know, and he gave up. But that, that disciple became a big Mahamaya. He never could even read it. Didn't even know the alphabet. While Saint Ignatius Loyola was temperamentally so adverse to study that it required immense effort for him to gain the degree without which the church would not allow him to teach, and he was middle-aged before he did so. A master may feel who are his people and draw them to him, but even that is no guarantee of a good outcome to the quest. Judas was among the closest followers of Christ, and Devadatta among those of Buddha. While Muhammad is told in the Quran, you cannot save those whom you will, but those whom God wills. What is required is rather willingness to open one's heart to the truth, to surrender oneself, give up one's ego, conceive of the possibility of its non-existence, give up one's life for Christ's sake. That is why the Quran speaks of unbelievers rather as perverse than ignorant, saying that even if an angel from heaven came down to explain to them, they would not listen. Theoretical understanding is not enough. Neither is belief in the sense of a conviction that this or that will happen after death. What is needed is to set one's hand to the plow, as Christ put it, to undertake the true alchemy, transmuting the dross in one's nature to gold. This is the quest of the Sangraha, the search for the elixir of life, the eternal youth of the spirit. It is the pathway of the heroes, the way from trivialities to grandeur. Its consummation is like waking up from a dream into the ever-existent reality. And here's a poem from the same author, Arthur Osborne. He considered himself a poet, really. This is the first edition of the Mountain Path.
Yeah.
first article. The few. No argument can pierce the shuttered mind. Let truth shine forth resplendent as the sun. Still, crouched in their dark corner, will they find some guttering candle till life's day be done. Even though we sang the angels in their ear, they would not hear. Those only whose heart some inkling dwells, grown over though it be, crushed down, denied, will greet the pealing of the golden bells and welcome truth when all around deride. Yet sight has laid a debt upon their will not all fulfill. For even of those who see, only a few will have the intrepid wisdom to arise and barter time's false values for the true, making their life a valiant enterprise to vindicate their heritage long lost, nor count the cost. And out of that so noble fellowship, questing the grail upon the mountain peaks, well is it if it meet the expectant lip, or even one persistently who seeks. Yes, is this quest the glory of the goal of the awakened soul? And he has some quotes. Ramana Maharshi, the 40 verses, verse number 2. As religions postulate the three fundamentals, the world, the soul, and God, but it is only the one reality that manifests itself as these three, one can say the three are really three, only as long as the ego lasts. Therefore, to inherit in one's own being, where the I or ego is dead, is a perfect state. And a quote from Tukaram, the entire world is God. This is the core of my teaching. First banish egoism, then you will come up to this test. Would you like to know the core of divine wisdom? This is my certain answer. Tuka says, rise above the mind and destroy the ego. And then a quote from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad commentary of Shankara. The result of knowledge is identity with all. The result of ignorance is identity with the limited being of one's body. In the Katha Upanishad, the Atman, self, is never born and never dies. It is beyond time, unborn, permanent, and everlasting. It does not die when the body dies. Then they have something from the chief minister of Madras, the Bhaktavatsalam. I have a section in Chennai, Bhaktavatsalam Nagar. I stayed there a couple of times. You know that Vedanathan used to come to Yellowstone? The Vedanathan used to come to Yellowstone Ashram. Yellowstone, where I know. He's like a retired engineer, sort of. Oh, here's Nagama's letter. Remain where you are. Nagama is an Andhra lady who was living here in the lifetime of Bhagavan. Her brother also is a great devotee, but could pay only occasional visits here, as he was the manager of a bank in Madras. Therefore, Nagama formed the habit of writing him reports of the doings and sayings of Bhagavan. Some of these letters have been put together as a book and published by the ashram. But what follows has not yet been published in English. 10th September 1947. It's been published in English. Now this is 1964.
So it was probably my life as your ashram or something.
No, they didn't publish them all in one book, you know, there. At a quarter of 10 this morning, just as Bhagavan was getting up to go for his usual short mid-morning walk, an under young man approached the couch and said, "Swami, I have come here because I want to perform tapas and don't know what would be a good place for it. I will go for the purpose wherever you tell me." Bhagavan did not answer. He was stooping down, rubbing his legs and knees, as he often does before beginning to walk, on account of the rheumatism in them, and was smiling quietly to himself. We, of course, were waiting eagerly for what he would say. A moment later, he took the staff that he uses to steady himself in walking and, looking at the young man, said, "How can I tell you where to stay? It is best to stay where you are." And with a smile, he went out. The young man was bewildered. "What is the meaning of this?" he exclaimed. "Being an elderly person, I thought he would tell me some holy place where I could stay. But instead of that, he tells me to stay where I am. I'm now near the couch. Does that mean that I should stay here near the couch?" Was it to receive such a reply that I approached him? Is this a matter for joking? One of the devotees took him out of the hall and explained, "Even when Bhagavan says something in a light vein, there is always some deep meaning in it. Where the feeling I arises is oneself. Tapas means knowing where the self is and abiding there. For that, one has to know who one is. And what then does it matter where one stays?" That is what he meant. He thus pacified the young man and sent him away. Similarly, someone asked yesterday, "Swami, how can we find the Atma?" You are in the Atma, so how can there be any difficulty in finding it? Bhagavan replied, "You say that I am in the Atma, but where exactly is that Atma?" The questioner persisted. "If you abide in the heart and search patiently, you will find it." The questioner still seemed unsatisfied and made the rather curious objection that there was no room in his heart for him to stay in it. Bhagavan turned to one of the devotees sitting there and said, smiling, "Look how he worries about where Atma is. What can I tell him? What is Atma? It is all-pervading. When I tell him that it is called heart, he said there is no room in it for him to stay. What can I do? To say that there is no room in the heart after filling it full of vasanas is like grumbling that there is no room to sit down in a house as big as Sri Ceylon. If all the junk is thrown out, won't there be room? The body itself is junk. These people are like someone who fills all the rooms of his house chock full of junk, which is not necessary for his body, and then complains that there is no room for his body in it. In the same way, they fill the mind with all sorts of vasanas, and then say there is no room for the self in it. If all the vasanas are swept away and thrown out, there will be plenty of room, and it will all be Atma. Then there will be no such thing as a separate I. So what need then for room, or who would occupy the room? Instead of seeking the self, they say, no room, no room. Just like shutting your eyes and saying that there is no sun. What can be done? Note on names. The names Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi and Arunachala will occur frequently in this journal. We are therefore inserting a note on their meaning and pronunciation for those readers who are not familiar with them. Sri, pronounced Sri, is a Sanskrit honorific, signifying blessed, or auspicious, and has now lost much of its meaning and come to be used before names, much like Mr. in English. Before the name of a Swami, a holy place, or a holy place, however, it still has its original connotation. Ramana is an abbreviation of the personal name Venkataramana. The accent is on the first syllable. Maharshi is a contraction of Maha Rishi, meaning the great Rishi, or great sage. The accent is on the second syllable, Maharshi. Bhagavan is the word commonly used for God. It is applied by common consent to one who is recognized as a divine incarnation, and it is the same as the appellation of the Buddha, which is commonly rendered in English as the Blessed One. It is usual to address the Maharshi in the third person as Bhagavan. He accepted this usage and sometimes referred to himself so. The accent is on the first and last syllables. The second slurred over. Bhagavan. Various meanings are assigned to Arunachala, the name of the sacred hill. The third and last vowels are long. Accent being mainly in the third, Arunachala. A remark may also be in place on the form Ramanashrama, which may confuse some readers. The word ashram has found its way into English dictionaries and is therefore the correct English form, whether or correct transliteration of the Sanskrit or not. However, ashramam is the Tamil form, and this ashram is registered under that name, which is therefore used for its address. Got that straight. So, outside the scriptures, by Dr. T.N. Krishnaswamy. He's the one that took most of the pictures of Bhagavan. You know, his grandson's living in California, goes to the Fremont, you know, I've been to his house. Last year he gave a presentation on him, his grandfather, during the program, you know, one of the main programs.
Here, right?
No,
yeah,
in Fremont. There's a quote, a special transmission outside the scriptures, no dependence upon words or letters, direct pointing at the heart of man, seeing into one's own nature, and the attainment of liberation. These are the reflections of a traveler on the mountain path laid down by the Maharshi. The Maharshi's wordless doctrine is unlike the usual traditional teachings. There are no creeds to be elaborated, so there is no need for preaching. There is nothing for the mind to theorize or philosophize about. What is needed is immediate, intuitive understanding of the heart. Quote, the intricate maze of philosophy of the various schools is said to clarify matters and to reveal the truth. But in fact, it creates confusion where none need exist. To understand anything, there must be the self. The self is obvious, so why not remain as the self? What need to explain the non-self? This is from the teachings of Sri Ramana Maharshi. Unquote. What the seeker has to do is rather to unlearn and let go all his preconceived ideas about the self. Indeed, the Maharshi has been known to say that in the end, even the scriptures must be given up and unlearned. Quote, all scriptures, without exception, proclaim that for attaining salvation, the mind should be subdued. And once one knows that control of the mind is their final aim, it is futile to make an interminable study of them. What is required for such control is actual inquiry into oneself by self-interrogation. Who am I? How can this inquiry in quest of the self be made by means of a study of the scriptures? Unquote. This reminds one of Chung Tzu's saying that if one gets rid of a small wisdom, great wisdom comes in. There's no precepts for special austerities, but at the same time, indulgence is not condoned. The question always is, who is it that seeks all this? To refer a second time to the Taoist sage, it is like Li Su's story of the animal trainer who subdued his tigers, the vasanas, by treating them quite impersonally, neither gratifying their desires nor provoking their anger. All thinking is out of place as a means of sadhana. It is not one's true nature. It creates all errors, and what is worst of all, creates as the father of them a false entity, the ego or individual being. Quote, concentration is not thinking of one thing. On the contrary, it is excluding all thoughts, since all thoughts obstruct the sense of one's true being. All efforts are to be directed simply to removing the veil of ignorance. Unquote. The Maharshi said that the self is not in books. If it were, anybody might become a sage by study. Also, it is not in any hermitage, and going to live in solitude will not help. Quote, why do you think you are a householder? The similar thought that you are a sannyasin will haunt you even if you go forth as one. Whether you continue in the household or renounce it and go to live in the forest, your mind haunts you. The ego is a source of thought. It creates the body and the world and makes you think of being a householder. If you renounce it, will only substitute the thought of renunciation for that of family and the environment of the forest for that of the household. But the mental obstacles are always there for you. They even increase greatly in the new surrounding. Change of environment is no help. The one obstacle is the mind, and this must be overcome whether in the home or in the forest. If you can do it in the forest, why not in the home? So why change the environment? Your efforts can be made even now, whatever be the environment. Unquote. Nor is the self something to be attained at some future date. Quote, no one is ever away from the self, his self, and therefore everyone is in fact self-realized. Only, and this is the great mystery, people do not know this and want to realize the self. Realization consists only in getting rid of the false idea that one is not realized. It is not anything new to be acquired. It must already exist, or it would not be eternal. And only what is eternal is worth striving for. Unquote. All doctrines are made by the ego and for the ego. The ego flourishes on them. But on the Maharshi path, the very existence of the ego is denied right from the start, both that of the teacher and that of the taught. Quote, there is no ego. If there were, you would have to admit of two selves in you. Therefore, there is no ignorance. If you inquire into the self, ignorance, which is already non-existent, will be found not to exist, and you will say that it has fled. Unquote. Is there anything in the human body that can be called I? There are mental and vital processes, but investigation reveals no person there to be designated as I. The negative process consists of intellectually eliminating the not-I, so that one can see that he who eliminates everything else cannot eliminate himself. Such intellectual investigation may prepare the way for self-inquiry, but it is not the inquiry itself. A visitor once asked, "I begin with asking myself, who am I? And eliminate the body as not I, the breath is not I, the mind is not I, but then I'm unable to proceed further." Well, that is all right so far as the mind goes. Your process is only mental. The truth cannot be directly indicated. That is why this mental process is used. You see, he who eliminates all the not-I cannot eliminate the I. In order to be able to say, "I am not this" or "I am that," there must be the I to say it. This I is only the ego or the I thought. After the rising up of this I thought, all other thoughts arise. The I thought is therefore the root thought. If the root is pulled out, the rest is at the same time uprooted. Therefore, seek the root I. Question yourself, who am I? Find out the source of the I. Then all those problems will vanish, and the pure self alone will remain. Unquote. Why was the Maharshi so against thought? Why was he not satisfied with mental investigation? Because it cannot see beyond itself. It is created by the ego and therefore cannot pierce to the self underlying the ego. But will its renunciation not result in a mere blank? It can. That is what happens in deep sleep. But it can also result in awakening into pure Satchitananda, being consciousness bliss. This is what is called realization. Quote, "Absence of thought does not mean a blank. There must be someone to be aware of that blank. Knowledge and ignorance pertain only to the mind and are in duality, but the self is beyond them both. It is pure light. There is no need for one self to see another. There are no two selves. What is not self is mere non-self and cannot see the self. The self has no sight or hearing. It lies beyond them, all alone, as pure consciousness." Unquote. Then does one who has realized the self remain absorbed in pure formless consciousness, oblivious of the outer world? He can. That is a state of trance known as Nirvikalpa Samadhi. But he need not. Full and complete realization involves return to formal consciousness also, with full perception of the outer world, not as a self-subsistent reality, but as a manifestation of the self. The mind and senses can still cognize. When one says that the mind is dead, that means only that it no longer presumes to imagine, create, or originate as it formerly did. This is the state the Maharshi was in. It is known as Sahaja Samadhi. Quote, "To those who have not realized the self, as well as to those who have, the word I refers to the body, but with this difference, that for those who have not realized, the I is confined to the body, whereas for those who have realized the self within, the body, the I, shines as a limitless self. To those who have not realized, as well as to those who have, the world is real. But to those who have not realized truth is adapted to the measure of the world, whereas to those who have, truth shines as the formless perfection and as the substratum of the world. This is all the difference between them. Unquote. Why is the Maharshi so insistent against the ego? Because the ego is the usurper of that claims to be the self, the mask that conceals the reality. Its elimination is the only way to realization of the true self, which underlies it. The seeker has no alternative. There can be no chick unless the eggshell is broken. The true self cannot be realized until the false is renounced. Therefore, the Maharshi says, since this is ultimately necessary, why not start with it straight away? Since you must finally remain as the self, why not do so from the start? Since other paths will lead you roundabout and finally face you with the alternative of self or pseudo-self, why not go direct and face it here and now? Quote, this is the direct method. All other methods are practiced while retaining the ego, and therefore many doubts arise, and the ultimate question still remains to be tackled in the end. But in this method, the final question is the only one and is raised from the very beginning. Because every kind of path except self-inquiry presupposes retention of the mind as the instrument for following it, and cannot be followed without the mind. The ego may take different and more subtle forms at different stages of one's practice, but it is never destroyed. The attempt to destroy the ego or the mind by methods other than self-inquiry is like a thief turning policeman to catch the thief that is himself. Self-inquiry alone can reveal the truth that neither the ego nor the mind really exists and enable one to realize the pure, undifferentiated being of the self or the absolute, unquote. Many hesitate and find this method too harsh because of all renunciations, this seems to them the most severe, renouncing not merely enjoyment, but him who desires and enjoys it. But this is a wrong idea. If it were true, a self-realized man, such as the Maharshi, would be the most miserable of men, whereas in fact he is the most happy in pure, unbroken, unalloyed happiness, regardless of whether outer circumstances seem favorable or unfavorable. This is because, in renouncing the ego, one really renounces nothing except a wrong conception of I, an error whose removal reveals the eternal truth and unalloyed happiness that is one's real nature. Quote, the individual being, which identifies its existence with that of the life in the physical body as I, is called the ego. The self, which is pure consciousness, has no ego sense about it. Neither can the physical body, which is inert in itself, have this ego sense. Between the two, that is, between the self or pure consciousness and the inert physical body, there arises mysteriously the ego sense, or the I notion, the hybrid, which is neither of them, and this flourishes as an individual being. The ego, or individual being, is at the root of all that is futile and undesirable in life. Therefore, it is to be destroyed by any possible means. Then that which ever is alone remains resplendent. This is liberation or enlightenment or self-realization, unquote. It is to remove this error that the Maharshi prescribes the inquiry, who am I, from the very start. He had no graded methods, nor did he grade his disciples according to seniority. Progress was an inner state which only he perceived. The aspirant is expected to understand that he does not know his self, to investigate into it in order to find out what it is really is. He must see, I am possessed of a wrong view of I am a slave of the pseudo-I. I should not take him for the real I, or lend him that name. This tragedy of wrong thinking has brought on me the sickness of a wrong eye. The Maharshi has prescribed the right medicine to cure me. I am under the spell of the ego, which has hypnotized and enslaved me. I myself gave it the power to do so by thoughtlessly bestowing my eye sense on it. By doing so, I am helping it to rob me of my very self. Indeed, the Maharshi often referred to the story of the King Janaka, who, on attaining realization, exclaimed, now I have caught the thief who has been robbing me all these years.